and welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. On Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and 1 a.m. on Monday mornings on this fine station, as well as the podcast being available both on the homepage of richarddugan.com and the radio show's page, as well as SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, and many other locations to come. We certainly encourage you to investigate the podcasts, especially considering the fact that a lot of times these interviews run much longer than just the 50 minutes that you hear on the radio. So go to those podcast locations, listen to the entire interview so you don't miss a thing. We encourage you to do so. We also encourage you to go to our guest's website. When you go to the SoundCloud playlist for this particular interview or any other interview, you're going to see in the upper right-hand corner, as you play that podcast, a little grocery cart. Click on it. That takes you to our guest's website. Most people probably use that for selling their podcasts or subscriptions or whatever it might be in terms of pay. It's the link to our guests, so please check it out. If you'd like to support what we're doing here, if what we're doing resonates with you, we would love your support. We have a PayPal account that you can put your support into. We'd greatly appreciate any and all amounts. We'll take energetic support as well. We are certainly in favor of that. So, again, it's richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, as well as the homepage, and you can go to the missions page for that PayPal link to support the broadcast. Today's program, I think we're going to enjoy greatly. I think you're going to enjoy it as much as I am. We're going to be talking with a gentleman who basically is joining us as a poet today. His latest work is called The Drum That Beats Within Us. This is poems by Mike Bond. And Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be there and to be in touch with Santa Barbara one way or another. So, yes, I'm delighted. Thank you.
Now, you've written a lot of different novels. I have a list of them here, but this particular work is a work of poetry, and the title in and of itself of the work itself, the book, The Drum That Beats Within Us, connotes more of an esoteric or a spiritual or even a metaphysical context. Explain to us about that.
Well, I think that poetry is a great way to get into deep feelings and to unite people in these feelings. And poetry is very different than writing a novel. Writing a novel has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you try to take the reader through real experience and impart something of value that you've learned in your own life. And poetry does the same thing, but in a different way. It uses as few words as possible to encourage the maximum emotional response. And it's by emotional responses, Richard, that I believe that we come together. So poetry links us together, and also the drum that beats within us speaks to a certain spirituality which goes beyond the individual and unites all of us in a world of feeling and understanding that we don't necessarily comprehend, even though we understand, we don't comprehend.
Well, I have to say that I do remember having to memorize at least one poem and recite it in front of the class in grade school. I don't remember what the poem was. And poetry, at least in the traditional sense, say in the context of your book, never really elicited a great interest. But what I have found over the years is that I have been a fan of poetry in spite of that, because much, if not most, of the music that I would listen to is basically a poetic form, isn't it?
Yeah, and I talk about that in the introduction to the book, The Drum That Beats Within Us. I talk about that poetry is really, these days, never had it so good, because so many, particularly rock lyrics, rock and roll lyrics, are magnificent poetry. Some, of course, are not, but we're now seeing a situation where poetry, which has always been a way of conveying a story through rhyme, and the purpose of rhyme is simply to remember things. But yeah, we have so many in the last 50 years or so, there have been so many extraordinary music pieces that are pure poetry, and most of them are rock and roll, but you take away the music and you still have magnificent lyrics.
Yeah,
in many cases.
There were a few that just were coming to mind as you were sharing that. One of them in particular, going all the way back to the 60s, if you were just to read it as is, it's still very poetic and it has great meaning, Blowing in the Wind.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for his poetry, basically, and it was it's poetry that's set to music.
Yeah.
And there's many others of the same period or slightly later. Pink Floyd, I mean, the whole Wall double album, Comfortably Numb, Wish You Were Here, etc. Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven is one of the great poetic pieces of the 20th century. Guns N' Roses, November Rain, Sweet Child of Mine. These are magnificent poems. Magnificent poems. Hotel California, I mean, speaking of Santa Barbara.
What, yeah,
a remarkable summation of a lifestyle and a way of thinking in just a few lines.
I know that in in each state in particular, I don't know if there's a national position, but I know that as individuals come up, they grow up in a region and they stay there for a while and maybe they produce the work that they do. There's what's called the Poet Laureate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what California's is. I can't remember. I know we have one in Arizona. I'm originally from Phoenix. And mm-hmm. I know that we have one, but I can't recall the gentleman's name. I do know probably one of the most modern day poets. I will have to say poetess, I guess it is, Maya Angelou, because I think she was, didn't she speak at one of Obama's inaugurations?
I believe she did, yes.
Yeah.
And she's on my list of the greatest poets in English, and I know why the caged bird sings, and her poetry about freedom is just extraordinary, and we should all be very grateful to Maya Angelou. She's opened many, she just gives us new visions and new dimensions. I totally agree. I don't know if she's a poet laureate or not, but she certainly should be.
She should be, absolutely.
She was the American one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if a lot of the as we discussed just a moment ago, of the songwriters, if in your list of, say, some of the best or greatest or what have you, aren't some of these songwriters? I think, mm-hmm. of course, my favorite artists in particular. Not every one of his songs, but I know that there is definitely a poetic verse and so forth in some of the songs of, say, Harry Chapin or John Denver.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I know that Carole King, who has had incredible success, both in music and, of course, I understand now on Broadway and so forth. I mean, these are some of our modern poets who bring to light. They're teaching people about poetry, people who probably don't even realize it, and love poems and don't realize that they're loving them because they've been set to music.
Yeah, Carole King is one of our greatest voices, and she has been for many years. Since we're on this, also I have to mention things like Don McLean's American Pie.
Yeah.
If you wish to have a complete description of a time and place. It's hard to do better than that. Or Bob Seger's Night Moves. I mean, it goes on.
Yeah.
Rolling Stones have had marvelous poems. And of course, the Beatles are extraordinary.
Yeah.
And we're just very fortunate that rock and roll came along and gave poetry new life.
Yeah. One song that comes to mind also, and we'll kind of shift off of this, I want to dive into some other things, but another song that every time I hear it, of course, it takes me back to my late high school days and after graduation, where I had, I called her my girlfriend, and we went out on a few dates, and she had, I never got to see the presentation, but she had put together some kind of video presentation, and the music for the background was Vincent, about Vincent van Gogh. And, of course, every time I see pieces on, say, Sunday morning on CBS, or, you know, that flashes back to mind. And that's just such a, not just a beautiful song, but just the words that are being spoken there are just wonderful feelings. How long have you been, writing poetry specifically? You've been writing a lot of other things as well, but poetry in particular.
I think I started about age 12. I would lie in bed at night like most kids, not able to sleep, and I would just, things would just stick into my head, rise up inside my head, rhyming segments, and I would memorize them and remember them in the morning, and then forget about them. But yeah, I've been writing poetry since I was probably 12 or 13, and to do rhyming poetry, of course, Richard, is different than doing non-rhyming, and most song lyrics are rhyming poetry, and it becomes easier and easier the more you do, because your brain, after a while, starts to seek rhymes automatically in meters. So, yeah, I've done it for a long time, and I still write poetry today.
Now, you've shared a little bit about poetry and feeling and emotion and so forth, but is poetry necessarily set up structurally to tell a story rather than to share a feeling, an emotion, from your perspective?
That's a super question. I think it can do both. I think that, I mean, I've said for a long time in many different ways that the only way we learn is emotionally. I mean, we can learn tons of facts and intellectual things, and they're valuable, and they help us get ahead in the world. But emotionally, we learn on a much deeper level, and it goes into the right brain. And I think poetry is a way to share incredibly deep understandings and feelings, because in our daily life, we ignore most of what's really important, which is, what is the question of life? What is death? What is love? I mean, what are we here for? Are we just here to go to the mall and watch football, or are we here for far deeper reasons that each one of us can explore on her or his own? And I think that poetry helps to remind us that life is very deep and profound and potentially valuable, as well as tragic. Mm-hmm. And I think poetry is a way to get there. I really do.
I'm also curious, because poetry falls under the category of the arts, if you will. Mm-hmm. How shall we say, financially successful, from your observation, from your research and interest, have poets been? Certainly their recognition is there, but in terms of benefiting from the artistry that they have put out, and of course right now we're kind of focusing more on American poets. We're going to dive into the diversity internationally in a moment. But what's your observation of that? Is it that same old saying that parents will tell their kids who want to go into the arts, there's no money in it, you need to find a regular job?
Oh, that's certainly true, Richard. I mean, I can remember the first time I was published in a big anthology, and it was an anthology put together by City Lights Books and Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and they put me right in the front. I had the first two poems, and I thought, wow, you know, this is great. The thing is selling and everything else. And finally, at the end of 3 months, I got a royalty check, and it was $15. And it wasn't that they were being unfair. It's just there's no money in it. So, but there never has been. And there was no money. Our ancestors that were making these long myths, the Viking myths and stuff like that, which rhyme incredibly, there was no money in that. It was just a way to dig into what's the deepest deepest level of human awareness and share that deep level, because the deeper we go in, the more we understand. So,
yeah.
No, there's never been any money in as far as author income. It's at the lowest point in recent history. And I'm one of the very fortunate ones that sells tons and tons and tons of books. So I'm free of that burden. But most writers do not even make a living wage.
But you're also rather prolific as well, and you don't just write poems, but you also have novels and so forth that are out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dive a little bit into the whole aspect of poetry as it expands. And of course, it's funny because it's usually said tongue in cheek. You know, I'm going to quote you a verse from the Bible, but it's not going to be King James verse. I can't do that. And then you, as you mentioned, you've got the Vikings. We're actually watching a series from National Geographic called Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible. And my wife's actually been doing some of the research in regards to the characters and what's been happening, and says that most everything that they talk about in this particular program, for example, there is one character, his name is Floki, and he ends up taking many of the Vikings to a place that eventually turns into Iceland. And
yep.
They're telling
yep.
that story. Then you also have the Japanese samurais. You have and one in particular I'd love to discuss, because I had a computer program game that I purchased, oh my gosh, maybe 20 years ago, on mm-hmm. floppy disks, right? Having
yeah.
to do with Shambhala, which is another, the Shambhala teachings of Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
The name of this game was called Heaven and Hell. But what it mm-hmm. was it was a series of puzzles that you had to solve. And they were all different. And as you solved the puzzle, you would move up a level. And when you solved a section of puzzles, then you were given this phrase from, you know, from Shambhala, right? And that was your gift. That was your prize. So this was more of an intellectual / esoteric kind of game that probably wouldn't sell too well today. I loved it. I absolutely loved it because it challenged my mind, my intellect, but then it also sort of fed my soul.
Sure.
Can you? I want to start there. I want to start with the whole mythology, if you will. Maybe you can share with us a little bit about that in the poetry of Shambhala. What is, where is, who is Shambhala?
Yeah, it's an unanswerable question.
Then we'll move on.
No, what I mean is that all good questions are probably unanswerable. I mean, other than where did I put the car keys? There's so much, and this is why I think poetry is so important. When we go through the, just as we have talked about in songs, when we go through the great works of poetic art, they give us, it's a door, it's Alice in Wonderland's door to the world we do not know, or we may only partially know it. And I think that Shambhala too, we continue to have more and more insight about what, in essence, well, it's like the great scientists say, we learn more and more about how little we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think Shambhala is the same thing. The universe in multiple dimensions and our own internal lives and our history and everything is beyond comprehension. There's no way we can understand it all. So we pick at it. We try to gain, like your clues that you got in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think poetry can be those clues too, as can songs.
Yeah.
And I think of if I tried to put together all of the poetry that I know across a number of different languages, if I pick what I would say is the number one finest poem I can think of, it would be Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. And he starts out in a very small poem talking just about the quality of the ocean on the beach at Dover And by the time the poem is over, a few lines later, he's brought into it the whole mystery and mystique of life in the universe, and good and evil and human fate. It's to do that is what your game with Shambhala did. It kept giving you clues to more. But there's an infinity of answers and an infinity of questions.
It's interesting when I start talking with my guests about some of these different ancient civilizations, the teachings, mm-hmm. and so forth. Some of the aspects thereof. I mean, as I mentioned before, we've been watching this series on the Vikings, and it seems mm-hmm. to be pretty true. They're not overly exaggerating the ferocity of the Vikings, especially in their fighting. When they go to battle, they're fighting as if they have nothing to lose. I mean, it's which is, of course, one of the reasons why so many civilizations were overtaken, including the Irish. And yet at the same time, they still also show the other side. I'll call it the tender underbelly. There's this incredible within many of the characters. There's this wonderful humanness. You know, it's like when they're battling, but boy, when they're back in camp and they've got family around them and all of this. There's a tenderness that is like, where did that come from? You know, and it's really incredible how that develops. Of course, it's just like in any civilization, there are some individuals who don't show that tenderness at all. They're pretty vicious and mean spirited, regardless of the circumstance. And
well, it's a yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, Richard, that I think the Viking series is one of the finest I've ever seen on television, and National Geographic consistently comes up with marvelous things. But it's so true to life. I'm actually, my bloodline is pretty much 100% Viking, and from the 7th and 8th century, coming from Scandinavia down into England and Ireland, as you said, So I've spent a lot of time studying the Viking myths and everything, and I was going to mention there's a book called the Havamal, Havamal, which is a very short, handbook on Viking thought, which is just absolutely marvelous. This was an immensely complicated culture with fantastic poetry in many, many aspects of it. But I think that, I mean, I've been in a lot of battle zones and very dangerous places with a lot of nasty people. And the nasty people, even as dangerous as some people are, they, you know, like the old song goes, but he loved his mother. And everybody has close families. And, you know, when we attack someone on the other side of the world, we're not attacking evil people. They think of us as evil people. I think one of the things, getting back to poetry again, is that it teaches us that we all have the same feelings. And so I think what you're saying about the Vikings, that they, yes, they're incredibly warlike, but at the same time, they have very profound and complicated family lives.
You know, some might even say that the Vikings are rather bipolar. Because of those two extremes, you know what I'm saying? And I think that the other aspect too, when you use that description, that same description could be placed upon a less successful but more modern day Vikings called politicians. And even when you say the word politician, you're saying it with a little bit of derision, a little bit of disgust,
yep.
and so forth. But by the same token, this is something that I am, not only am I trying to sort of assimilate within myself because I need to be in this space, but also trying to share with others. Okay, I get that you're upset. I get that you're angry. I get that you're whatever the emotion is, but you have to remember that they are, strange as it may sound, they're human beings too. They have families too.
Yeah.
And I realize that the way they're behaving in front of the camera or what have you you know, is unpleasant or unpalatable, whatever. But and I realize that for many of us, that's really hard to swallow. That, oh my, these are human beings too. Really, look what they're doing. So, mm-hmm. I understand that, but you make mistakes too. You have foibles. I mean, if all of our quote unquote dirty laundry was laid bare for all to see, would you pass the same test that you're putting upon these people? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not giving anybody a pass. I'm just saying that in order for us as a civilization to flourish and move forward, we're going to have to get back to the basics of who we are as a community. We're a community of human beings who have hurts and happiness and feelings and family and struggles and so forth and so on. And I know that that is also laid out in your poetry. Is there a particular poem that you have written, maybe even in the context of The Drum That Beats Within Us, which is the book that our guest Mike Bond is sharing with us today, along with a lot of other things as well? Is there a particular poem that might express those kinds of sentiments, or have you gone in that direction? If you don't have a specific poem, how about your own internal workings and dealings with humanity, and then the compartmentalized parts of humanity?
Well, I think Richard, that because in certainly in my novels, what I try to do in my novels is to bring readers to a part of the world and a part of life that they may not be familiar with. I like to think that I give voices to the voiceless. And so, yeah, I mean, most of my life has been spent in what for us as Americans is a foreign culture, whether it's a tribe in Africa or Tibetans or Indians in South Africa or South America. I mean, I think that, and yes, we are all one. And I think one of the things that, returning just briefly, and I'll get to your question about is there a poem of mine. I think that as Americans, we have to be particularly aware that the world is watching us, that we are the world's leading nation, and that we are the nation that everybody in the world wants to come to, and which is why some of the pressures exist, because I can tell you, wandering around Africa, everybody wants to come to the United States. Wandering around Latin America, everybody wants to come to the United States. Even in Asia, pretty much if everybody wants to come to the United States, we stand for freedom, individuality, openness, all of these wonderful things that everybody wants. And so, yes, we have to be aware that we're all Americans, and we actually want the same things. We just believe in going about it a different way. Everybody wants people to be happy and families to be loving, and nobody wants war, and except a few nutcases who watch too many video games. But you know, I think we have to be much more conscientious and conscious of the things that link us rather than the things that divide us. So, I certainly believe that what's worldwide, this, when I sit down in a village in some dusty part of the North African desert, the person that I'm talking with is no different to me than my high school teacher was years ago, or a friend that lives down the road from me. And we're all potentially friends. We just have to open up more to each other.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I in terms of a poem that covers that, I don't know. I would say that, I've got in my book, I've got one. The second poem in my book is called Golden Gate Bridge, and it's about a girl whom I knew who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, and I didn't know her well. She was just a friend of a friend, so to speak, but a wonderful, brilliant young woman. And so in that poem, I try to discern what is it that leads to a rejection of life, and how can that be stopped? Because it's ludicrous. I mean, we all get to die, so there's no reason to push it earlier than we have to. And so that's my exploration into the mind, if you wish, of someone unlike myself. And in fact, many of my poems are based on North American, Indian, Native American concepts and thoughts. So that's another way to get into a world larger than one's own mind. I'm taking forever to answer a very simple question. But
No. We have plenty of time. Not a problem. Mike Bond is my guest, and we are talking about the drum that beats within us. We're kind of featuring that on this particular program, but we're talking about a lot of different things here on the program. We're going to continue doing just that as we continue talking with Mike Bond. MikeBondBooks.com is the website. We certainly encourage you to investigate his work. We are very excited about having him on the program. MikeBondBooks.com. And again, as I said, we will be linked to his website. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We ask you to stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, along with Mike Bond. He is the author of the latest work, The Drum That Beats Within Us. And this course was released back in November of 2018. But here we are in the midst of 2019, and lots of stuff going on. It's just a remarkable time in which we live. Of course, people have been saying that phrase probably every year for time immemorial. Because there are always extraordinary things going on in the world. You left off sharing with us about your poetry and how it tends to derive a lot of the poetry, especially in the drum that beats within us. And, of course, I picked up on this not only from the title, but also from the picture of the buffalo on the front cover, on the plains, it looks like. And Native American influence. Now, you said that you're predominantly, say, Viking, Norseman, as it were. And every culture has its tribal aspects. I'm watching. We're both watching the Viking series, and that's just pretty evident there as well. But when you talk about the Native American Indian tribes, there are I can't believe how many there are. I mean, I grew up in Arizona. With numerous reservations all over the place. Obviously you can see the influence throughout Arizona and, of course, the Southwest, California and so forth, probably even up into Nevada. I mean, and certainly it spreads throughout. But tell us how this particular culture, and again, it's a rather large, you know, coverall, sort of generic, how did the Native American culture influence you? What was it that impacted you and sort of took you down that particular road?
That's a really good question, Richard. And what I would say to begin with is, and yes, there are thousands of tribes and hundreds of thousands of clans and many millions of North Americans prior to the coming of the Europeans to North and South America. But for me, what did it is when I was young, we lived in, and I'm talking about age 3 and 4, we lived in a very rural area, and there was simply, it was several miles walk to school when I got old enough to go to school. But there was, I had absolutely no friends. There was no one who lived anywhere near me. So once I walked home from school, I was on my own, but we were surrounded by forest. Surrounded by a very deep forest. And so I ended up spending all of my life out in the forest. And as a young kid, at 5, I would just head out in the morning on weekends and come back at night. And I would wander the forest and climb hills and try to figure out what was beyond the next hill. In other words, I grew up very close to nature. And so I was immensely touched by the Native American closeness to nature and the myths, and I, as I said earlier in our previous discussion, I try to be the voice for the voiceless. And so to a certain extent, I try to keep everyone aware of the great wisdom of the Native American culture. And because I see in our cities and our kind of hectic lifestyle today and internet and everything else and social media, that we become rootless. We lose touch with what's really important. And you can say it very simply, we don't have our feet on the ground. And because the ground, we have our feet on concrete. And I think that we lose a lot. So my poetry is an attempt to get back to that, an attempt to be in touch with the earth. And I promise you that you get out and spend several weeks out on the prairie in Montana, and you become a different person, in a much more deeply rooted, happy person. So I think that's what I'm trying to do with this poetry, is to reach back into our ancestral sources. And we all lived in caves at one point, and we hunted food. Nearly all of what we ate was animals that we killed. And there, we should at least have some awareness of that past to keep us going into the future.
You know, it's interesting that you say this, because that is the message that has been conveyed by more guests on this program than any other message, and that is the reconnection with nature. But the funny thing, well, I suppose you could call it funny, there are no coincidences. There are coincidences, but no coincidences,
well
as I
put.
Like to say. Okay. I have been saying for decades that I don't care what work you do. I don't care what industry you work in. I don't care what part of the world you live in. Nature is the ultimate teacher for mankind. There is no better teacher than nature. And I always use this one example, my friend. Show me what species on this planet, aside from man, that stores up goods for more than one season.
Interesting.
And I have not been told by anybody that there is any other species other than man that stores up, and I think immediately what comes to mind, of Twinkies that will last 1,000 years possibly.
Oh,
they'll,
yes.
They'll be as good today as they'll be as good then as they were today.
And or as bad, if you
or as bad. Or as bad, exactly.
Right.
And also, when talking about, like we've been talking about National Geographic, of course, the Viking series, but when you start watching some of these programs where you see the lion chasing the wildebeest, and you hear the narrator talk about predator and prey and that whole dynamic, right?
Yeah.
Well, for the lion and the wildebeest, that's just life. There's no predator-prey.
Yeah.
There's no duality. That's just life. I don't know about you. I'm not sure where you're living, but I live above Santa Barbara, in what's called the San Marcos Pass. And I actually live at the summit. So when it rains and they talk about flooding, I don't have to worry about it, because I live, up at the top of a hill for the most part. And
that's
so
great.
It's not likely that I'm going to have any mudslides, because there's lots of trees and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, I have been blessed since I moved here in 2006, May of 2006, with experiences not only with our own animals, chickens, cats, dogs. We had a tortoise at one time. We had a blue-tongued skunk, who actually does have a blue tongue, and is,
wow.
For the best description, it's like a snake with legs. That's kind of what he was like.
Right.
But we've also had, we had a flock, and I mean a big flock, 20, 30 wild chickens roaming the property where we live. We've had a bear on the property. We've had bobcats and our wild, I'm not sure if it was a bobcat or what kind of a cat it was, because it was hard to tell at night. We've even taken in, sadly, there was a kitten couldn't have been more than a few weeks old, that had just been dumped by somebody, and it had worked its way up the hill towards our home. And for two nights, mm-hmm. we heard this meowing out in the grasses. And of course, we were thinking, you know, that could be a cub, and you don't want to mess with the cub if mama's around because you get hurt. Mm-hmm. But finally, we went out there after the second night, and it was a black and white kitty, a small little kitten. And we took it in, and it grew to be about 20 pounds. You know, we've had these incredible experiences, and also learning from people who've lived here for many years about how to take care of oak trees and how to do these. And then, of course, also the you know, preparing for fire season and those kinds of things, just doing the preparation, those types of things. And watching, and we've also had a family of deer. Most recently, we've had a family of deer. Haven't seen them since the rain started. Hopefully they will come back. But it's just been extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think it puts us in touch. I hesitate to use the words real life, but because life is always what you make of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is real life. I mean, for millions of years, we humans have lived with many other animals, and we lived with wolves or close proximity to wolves long before we had dogs. And we've had many animal partners over the years. A cat is a perfect example of an animal partner in that we feed it, and in return, it keeps our. I mean, back when they started getting domesticated about 7,000 BC, mm-hmm. cats were kept because when we became agriculturalists and stopped being pastoralists and hunter gatherers, we were storing grain. As you pointed out, we're the only animal that stores longer than one season, and we would store, and the cats kept the rats and the mice out of the grain.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a symbiosis, as it was with the wolf cubs that we took in, which became the race of dogs. So we're very closely connected to the animal world, and the problem with living in a big city often is that we forget that connection. We literally do not walk on the earth, and the only bird we see is pigeons, which is a very low form of bird life. But actually, they're fun in the wilderness. But anyway, so I certainly agree that these things, like you were saying about where you live, is so important because it keeps us in touch with reality.
Yeah. You know, and of course, that's not to say that everybody that lives up on the mountain here or in any other rural area is doing their best to take care of the place that they are living in, but we are doing what we can without bringing in too much of the rest of the world. But certainly we do have internet, and we have phone, and we have electricity and those types of things. But, you know, we're also very – I remember when we first moved there, you know, I always said that I want to treat this – in this context, that if I lived in both places, if I lived below me, down the hill from me, I am not going to do an oil change at the top of the hill and just let the oil flow down, just drop it on the ground and let it flow down, because I live below me. And what's that going to do not only to the earth as it's flowing down, but what's going to happen when it gets to me? It's just real interesting, and that's why sometimes I cringe when I hear the word, and again, I'm not becoming political here in the interview, but when I hear the word conservative, the word conserve is in that word, but I'm not seeing a lot of that happening. But at the same time, I'm also seeing environmentalism run amok. When I moved here and I started learning about the various regulations in the state of California, I came up with this analogy. The regulations of California are kind of like this. You are standing in the middle of a chessboard. You can choose whichever center square you want, a black or a white square. And here are the regulations. You can't move forward. You can't move backward. You can't move to the left. You can't move to the right. And you can't move diagonally in any direction. And you can't stay there. Now, the
that
other
sounds like human fate. Yep.
It does. Now, the other side of that, my friend, is why were regulations established in the first place? Well, they were established in the first place because businesses refused to do the right thing. Why do you think we have child labor laws? Now, have they run amok? You betcha. Gone way too far over to the other side. I'm not in favor of the methods that the current administration has chosen to do that, to change things. Be that as it may, you know, I don't personally, I don't care about regulations. I'm using nature as my guide. What is best for me, for the other people who live on the mountain, who live below me on the mountain, and for the animals and plants that are on the mountain and below? That's my set of regulations. And, you know, it's just, a matter of fact, I heard about one of these fires that started here in California in 2018 was started because an individual had a piece of wood in their fireplace that started smoking up the interior of the house, and they carried it outside and tossed it out into the yard.
Great.
No joke.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, you got to be brain dead to do something like that.
Now,
but,
have I done that? I've gone up to the point where I have had to remove a log from the fireplace, carry it outside, but I happen to have an enclosed fire pit outside that's raised up above the ground that has mesh netting around it with a lid on it. And so it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remove the mesh netting circle and put the lid directly down over the surface of the fire pit, and basically it extinguishes whatever fires or embers are there.
But
what you're saying about nature, you're also, in addition to your travels and many of the other things that you've written, you're an environmentalist as well, ecologist, if you will. That wasn't that the phrase that was used back in the 70s and 80s, that you were an ecologist as opposed to an environmentalist?
That may be, yeah. To me, an ecologist is someone who has rather extensive knowledge of ecology. In other words, how it works, how things go together, and specific profound awareness of some natural sources and some natural rhythms. Whereas an environmentalist, to my mind, is just someone who is dedicated or wishes to protect the environment. And I can give you an example of environmentalism run amok, in that we are in the United States, since we have become very concerned about global warming, instead of doing real things about it, we've gone off and done incredibly harmful things. And the best example is so-called wind farms, which do absolutely nothing to reduce CO2 generation, may in fact add it because of how they force utilities to operate. And they have enormous, drastic environmental impacts on the land and on animals and birds and bats. And because they produce this hideous thing called infrasound, they actually do harm to people and livestock and everything else. But that's an example of where the wind turbine companies make so much money on taxpayer gifts that they then pass this money on to the Sierra Club and other environmental groups, who then promote wind power, even though in terms of kilowatt delivered, it's the most environmentally damaging form of power generation. And you can see that in so many areas where, yes, the environment is very important, but we're doing all the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one has to be careful of all such fads.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, and Santa Barbara is a perfect example, 35% of the average household electricity bill is for hot water. And you can very cheaply put a hot water, solar hot water panel on the roof and never have to heat water. And it's the same thing with solar panels. Most residential homes in the Southwest could be entirely powered by solar panels combined with batteries. But this puts a lot of utilities out of business. So the utilities have done their best to squash solar panels, And the politicians have gone right along with it because they get money from the utilities, which is necessary to keep them in office, contributions. So
yeah,
we have to be very careful with dogmatism in all forms, is I guess what I'm saying.
I couldn't agree with you more. We've and I've gone back to this point over and over again. And again, I'm not trying to be political in this comment, but I think that the greatest harm that was done to our society and our civilization, especially in regards to the media, was in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan abolished the fairness doctrine in broadcasting. And I'm sure you're probably familiar with it. Some of our listeners are not. And it basically said that if you are going to cover a subject, you must cover as many sides as possible, not just give one side. As soon as that was abolished, the echo chambers were created. And and all of this extremism has started. I still remember.
Yeah.
And so, it's really unfortunate from that standpoint because we don't investigate. I mean, I remember my boss giving me a task of investigating a particular thing, and I spent a month researching it and making phone calls and sending letters. And this was back in the 80s before the internet. And when the month was up, I came back to him with a full report, and basically he said, okay, well, we're not going to do anything. We're not going to pull that ad. You know, I appreciate your research, you know, but basically I had given him a lot more information than he had ever wanted, which was fine, but it's just, but it's like nobody is doing that anymore. And especially when, because everybody is only going to those locations on the internet that feed their particular perspective. I removed all of the news service apps from my phone and tablet and my computers. Now, do I watch the news? Sure. I get the local news and we will watch sometimes the evening news on the network level. But I remember when Peter Jennings was on ABC, I remember sitting watching once and thinking, this was before Comedy Central's The Daily Show. I said, there needs to be a laugh track behind this. There really does, because some of the stories were just so silly. Although that's when, back when Jennings was doing it, that's when news was really news and not fluff.
Yeah. Right.
But let's kind of shift gears just a little bit before we run out of time. You as you said, you've been in some rather dangerous places, militarily and so forth around the world. But you are also a human rights journalist as well as a war journalist. And certainly we've seen, oh my goodness, we've seen just, in my own lifetime, I have just seen and heard, not that I've ever had direct evidence, I can't imagine what the citizens of these various countries around the world are going through when they have to leave their homes, grab their kids by the hand, and race to the border to get out of the country that they were born and raised in order to feel safe. And even then, they aren't. And whether it's Syria or Lebanon or Tibet or Mexico, I've never experienced that. Can you talk to me about some of your experiences in some of these parts of the world that you've traveled?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned those countries, and I've been in all of those countries in wartime. And in fact, one of my novels, well, several of my novels concern that kind of thing, Holy War, which takes place in Lebanon and Syria, Assassins, which takes place in Afghanistan and Iraq principally. And it's heartrending, and the problem is, and it's the same problem too that the Jews in Europe faced in the 1930s. Things continue to get worse and worse and worse. At what point do you leave everything that you've built up and your family has built up over generations, grab the kids, try to take whatever money you can get a hold of and get out of there? And the same in Syria. I mean, Syria was my favorite country in the Middle East. I loved it there. And it was a complex country and full of interesting cultures And there was no reason for this war. Well, the war came in from exterior. But, yeah, I've been through it many times in Latin America. I wrote the book House of Jaguar about the human rights and disaster in Guatemala and El Salvador, and turned it into a thriller where somebody is attempting to solve these things and what problems do they get into. So, yeah, I've spent a good part of my life, and I think I've been emotionally connected with many people in these situations where they had to leave and leave their culture. And you can find them now living, somebody who had a nice home in Syria and with a lovely family now may have lost their family and they're living under a bridge in London. So, you know, part of it is the drastic overpopulation of the world. But right now, I mean, when you look at a situation in Africa, for instance, where 70% of the people in sub-Saharan Africa are 14 years old or younger, 70%. So that means in about 30 years or 20 years, there's going to be a population explosion in Africa that's going to be unbelievable. And there's no way that Africa can feed all these people. There's no way the world can. So what we're seeing in the future is going to be a heck of a lot worse than even where we are now.
Mm. 7.6 billion people at present and growing. And, and I just wonder sometimes if maybe we should say, hey, enough, stop. I mean, you can't do that because of the maternal instinct that kicks in specifically with women and families and so forth. They want to carry on the lineage. I understand that. I remember sharing with my father that I wasn't going to have kids because I didn't want to pass on the genes that gave me the visual impairment. And, of course, he understood that, but he says, you do realize that if I'd made that decision, you wouldn't exist. And I says, yeah, I do understand that. It's perfectly understandable to me. I get it. But I'm not going to bring kids into this world and have them go through what I went through in spite of the technologies that have finally caught up with me where I received a lens implant and now I can drive. Couldn't believe it when I was driving through L.A. traffic for the first time. It's like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Amazing?
Yeah. And yet at the same time, you know, it's like, how many more people do we need? But that's really not answering the maternal instinct. That has nothing to do with the maternal instinct. How many people do we need? The maternal instinct is, this is what I want. I want a child. Mm-hmm. I want children. I want a family. I want this small little community. If you, I mean, my parents had six. You know, that was a heck of a community. Let me tell you. living in a three bedroom house with one bathroom. That was quite exciting. Let me tell you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. Yeah, well, I think what we have to do is to, worldwide, we have to, as you said earlier in our discussion, we have to find some way of imposing limits because we're running out of earth. And you can see it in Africa, where I spend a lot of my time. And the problem in Africa is that you have In the past, you would have 12 or 14 children, and 8 of their or 12 of them would die. And now, thanks to modern medicine, all of the children are living. And so we're getting to the point where you divide up the arable land among your children, and there's less and less and less per child. And now we've gotten to the point where there isn't enough arable land to support the people that are living there.
Yeah.
And it's the same in Mexico. I lived for years in and out of Mexico, and it's been a tragic downturn in Mexico, which has been mostly driven by America's desire and appetite for drugs. If you took away cocaine, Mexico wouldn't have anywhere near the problems. And it's not that the Mexicans are using the cocaine. It's that the North Americans are using mm-hmm. the cocaine, and it's going through Mexico.
Well,
so
you know,
everything is linked, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. I'd actually heard a statistic, too, going back to the population issue, that educated women specifically, because this was what it was geared towards women, educated mm-hmm. women are less likely to have multiple children and will probably wait longer to have start a family than those who are not as educated or uneducated. And I think that it's not so much that we need to impose limits as much as to educate people. I still firmly believe, I don't know about you, Mike, but I still firmly believe that there's enough resources on this planet for every single human being. The problem isn't the supply, it's the distribution more than anything else.
Totally.
But at the same time, taking your comment about the land, the issue of the land is also very important as well, because you can't live everywhere. I mean, I used to joke with people when I was living in Phoenix, who was the nut job that thought it was a good idea to live in the desert? Well, if you lived in the desert, the real desert, yes, the days were hot, but the nights were nice and cool. And I remember growing up when it would hit 110 in the shade in the daytime and get down into the 60s at night, or at least lower 70s.
It
is possible. But then, of course, they laid out, as you said before, they laid out more concrete and asphalt and took out the flora. And then they would put in what they called desert landscaping. I've been in the desert.
Yeah.
Okay. I've driven through the desert. I have never seen gravel in the desert. Okay?
That's a good point. That's a great point.
Mike Bond, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. This has just been a joy. The Drum That Beats Within Us is the title of your latest work, Poems by Mike Bond. Mike Bond Books is the website, MikeBondBooks.com, where you can find out more about Mike, the other books that he's written, the novels and essays and articles and so forth. And we encourage you to do that. We will be linked to your website, Mike, and we hope that folks will go there. Before we let you go, first of all, I want to invite you to Santa Barbara. Should you ever be in this area, we would love to sit down in studio and talk more about this. Meanwhile, certainly we will utilize the technologies that are available and look forward to having you back on in the near future.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. It's been a joy. But we've kind of covered a lot of subjects here, from Vikings to desert flora and fauna, and it's all been fascinating. It's a great program, and you really do follow your theme of tell me your story, and you've had many wonderful stories on the program, and so I thank you for being there and appreciate very much the invitation, and wish everybody out in Santa Barbara a wonderful time.
Absolutely.
It's a great place to be.
Well, before we let you go, I have three final questions for you, but I want to remind our listeners of this program. And if you're listening to the radio version, please go to the podcast locations I've mentioned, SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, as well as the homepage at richarddugan.com to listen to the entire interview. My three final questions for you, Mike, are, number one, who is Mike Bond?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think someone who's continuing constantly to try to find out what life is and how best to live it, not for myself but for us all. I think that's who I am, and I'm very happily married for many years. I have a lovely family, lots of kids and grandkids, and I live very close to nature.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I want to share awareness. I've spent a lot of my life trying to understand the human condition and what it means to be alive and what death is and what we should be doing in this universe and what our future is, what the universe is. So I think that it's just to share that knowledge, to continue to investigate. When I was a kid and I was living in the wilderness, and I would get to the top of a ridge, and it would be getting dark and time to go home, and I'd see another ridge a mile away, and I'd think, what's on top? What's beyond that ridge? And so I would take off to see what the unknown was, and that's what I'm still doing. And then what I find, I love to share with others.
Final question, what is your life's purpose?
Kind of what I just said, Richard, it's my life's purpose is to live as deeply, productively, and happily as I can, and with others and to make other people's lives, as to contribute in every way I can to the happiness and productivity and profound life of others, I would say.
MikeBondBooks.com is the website. We've been talking with Mike Bond today. The latest work is The Drum That Beats Within Us, poems by Mike Bond. And again, my thanks to you for giving us so much time here on Tell Me Your Story to share yours and your philosophy as well. And again, a great program. We hope that lots of folks will go to your website, MikeBondBooks.com.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. Again, as I said, it's been wonderful to be on the program. It's a wonderful program, and you have really expanded the vision of what life is for a lot of people. So keep on trucking.
Thank you very much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.